You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. Brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the world's finest bookmaker, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. To celebrate the launch of Nick Luck Daily, Fitzdares have a special sign-up offer that will double your winnings on your first bet up to a £50 stake. Just go to www.fitzdares.com/luck to sign up. Hi and welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us as we bring you the latest news and sharpest insight from around the racing world. And I'm really pleased to announce today a new addition to these podcasts. Every Tuesday, in partnership with Weatherby's Bloodstock Services, we'll be bringing you a burst of pedigree expertise and none more expert than Nancy Sexton, who'll be joining me later on. And while we're in buoyant mood, some positive news overnight, the ITV were very close to ratifying a deal that has now been agreed with British Racing to extend their coverage for 3 years until the end of 2023. It's not going to come as a great surprise, perhaps, but it's a welcome boost for the sport and one that will certainly have settled a few jitters, as this has been nervy to-ing and fro-ing in rather tense fashion for several months. Now, joining me to discuss this and its ramifications for the sport is the Racing Post senior writer and media commentator Lee Mottershead. Lee, what's taken them quite so long?
A series of very bizarre delays, really. The intention had been to announce this on January 1, 2019, so a year and a half plus late. And initially, there was a delay caused by Ascot signing a direct-to-home deal with Sky, which upset ITV. The next major stumbling block was Delia Bushell replacing Simon Bazalgette as chief exec at the Jockey Club. Simon had been very keen to get a deal over the line quickly with ITV. They entered exclusive negotiations with ITV quite early in ITV's current deal period, but Delia comes from a TV rights background and she felt she could improve the structure of the deal for racing away from the actual free-to-air racing content. So that caused delays. And I think it has to be said, a delay was caused, or problems were caused, because the actual relations between Delia and her counterpart at ITV, the director of sport there, Niall Sloan, have not been good. They don't have, or they haven't had, a particularly healthy working relationship. That hasn't helped things. Then COVID-19 came along. ITV clearly lost a huge number of days, including the Grand National, the most valuable part of its contract content, and there was then debate about what sort of rebate ITV should get. There were store payments. Then most recently, there was a debate over streaming rights with ARC. So lots of different things have caused this to be delayed. And I think to outsiders, it has seemed very strange, because we're 3.5 years into what has almost been the longest honeymoon period in racing broadcasting. The critical coverage of ITV has been very positive. The ratings have been very strong, and they were the main reason why ITV won the rights in the first place. So I think to outsiders, it has seemed confusing and dangerous that it has taken so long. But finally, at last, it's over the winning post.
Okay, so in a new 3-year contract, can racing expect anything meaningfully different from what it's getting now?
They're getting a bit more money. So previously, racing was getting about £7.5 million a year. And by racing, really, we mean the Jockey Club and Ascot. They're the ones that get the lion's share of the rights fee. That moves up to between £8 and £9 million a year. So there's a financial increase on that. The content will largely be the same. So around 94 days spread across ITV, the main channel, and ITV4. I think where there is scope to develop the contract is in Sundays. We've spoken on this podcast in the past about the improved Sunday programme. That's working very well for ITV in terms of ratings. It's clearly working well for racing and race courses in these strange times. I think the pressure will be that these Sunday programmes have been created because good races have been moved onto Sundays, with the BHA having had control of the fixture list and knowing that race courses aren't having any attendance or hospitality income. If that changes next year and we return to more normal times, there's a chance that race courses won't be so minded to stage quality racing on Sundays. The challenge, therefore, is on racing as a whole to deliver a Sunday fixture list that will be sufficiently strong to merit ITB coverage. And if that is the case, I think we could go above 100 days a year for ITB next year, which would benefit everybody.
Well, if the deal is signed as we expect and confirmed this afternoon, I'm hoping that Ed Chamberlain, ITV's lead presenter, will be joining me on this podcast tomorrow. Let's move on and talk about something rather worrying, which was a semblance of a hole in the ground at Yarmouth yesterday, which led to the abandonment of racing. Now, there is no suggestion necessarily that the hole caused the fatal fall of a horse and an injury to Gabriella Maloon, and a fall for Gabriella Maloon. But notwithstanding that, Lee, it's concerning that track husbandry is under pressure and under scrutiny.
Yeah, listen, whenever you find a hole on a racecourse during racing, it's hugely concerning. What was interesting was that, as you say, Yarmouth have had issues in the past. The track was closed 6 years ago to level and straighten the course from ridges that had caused problems there in the past. So they have done a lot of intensive work at Yarmouth. It hasn't been entirely plain sailing since then. But the early stages of racing yesterday didn't throw up any problems. PJ McDonald, who's the jockey safety officer, he rode in earlier races and again couldn't find a problem. But then after the fall, they're out on the track and they found more than one hole in the race course. Now, what's interesting is they're due to race there on Friday. And as we speak now, the signals they've given are confident that racing can take place. But for Yarmouth, it's clearly a significant concern, not just because of the present problem, but because of their backstory.
So what kind of added pressure does the current situation place on racecourses and their clerks? I've been speaking to the Director of Racing and Clerk of the Course at Sandown Park, Andrew Cooper.
Well, I think the main difference, Nick, that we've faced is the volume of races that we're staging per card since resumption, which obviously was set at a minimum of 8. There was a period where that extended to 10 and still is potentially 9 on any race card. Now, and obviously a sort of out of kilter and different fixture list at the same time to that which we normally would have been working to. So I think the key difference is that volume of racing that we are, you know, sort of still currently putting on.
And at some tracks, of which Yarmouth would be one, the fields have been quite sizable. They've raced 8 times since resumption. When you look from a distance at what took place yesterday, what would your observations as a grounds manager be?
Well, I think you'd probably Yarmouth would have probably raced about 8 times in a normal year anyway. So, you know, I would hesitate to think it's anything to do with perhaps the volume of racing in this instance. Obviously, the track will have been thoroughly walked and whatever beforehand, as all tracks in this country would be. You know, there's a good team of clerks of the course and race course managers out there these days, in my opinion. The course was raced over perfectly, satisfactorily in the earlier races, and sometimes these things can just pop up. It could be, you know, it just could just be one of those things. And I think, you know, once they've obviously done a little bit more exploring, had a closer look at what the situation is in that final furlong, I'm sure they'll put it right pretty swiftly.
And I guess that's part of the hazard of the job of being a clerk of the course, is that sometimes incidents pop up that you simply can't foresee.
Very much. I mean, the whole job is one of trying almost to anticipate problems, you know. And I mean, using Sandown as an example, the part of the track that, particularly for flat racing, And in all honesty, probably only for flat racing, that sort of, I say, worries us going into any meeting, is to make sure we've got the bottom bend, the home bend into the home straight right for racing at speed. And that's actually the area of the course where we always suffer most damage in a normal year running sort of six race cards. And you're certainly starting to notice that we've been running, you know, sort of almost seven, eight races around that bend through this period as we speak. You know, we're starting just to sort of run out of what we would call, you know, sort of usable ground down there because of the volume of racing that we have been doing, and with some pretty big field sizes as well, actually, in Sandown terms. You know, we're running programs that are not sort of normal on the whole Sandown programs. They're being given to us by the BHA, funded by the levy board, which we accept and understand. But it does mean that, for example, we, you know, on Sunday at Sandown just gone, we were running a day full of class five races, which obviously wouldn't be the case. Funnily enough, that actually didn't mean a great increase in the number of runners, but we've been having some sort of 16, 17 runner handicaps, which probably great in betting turnover, but my word, you do notice the difference of in terms of turf damage with a sort of 16, 17 runner race late on in a card than you do with perhaps running seven or eight runner handicaps.
So is that something as an industry that we need to be mindful of, indeed worried about, as we push on into the autumn? Do we need to start thinking about alternative scenarios?
I'm not sure it's necessarily something to worry about, and I've thought about this a lot of late, but I think it is one for us to be conscious of as an industry in terms of how we take the sort of format of race days, number of races, that number of fixtures forward. It's got to be, I think, part of the discussion, because, you know, I certainly, you know, wearing my Sandown hat, I'm not sure I'd want to be, you know, again or longer term running a period of, you know, sort of five or six race meetings as we are at the moment, with sort of eight, nine race cards and the volume of wear and tear that the course is naturally suffering. I think it's just got to be part of the discussion. It isn't just as simple as saying, oh, there's economies of scale and suit certain parts of the industry to have these sort of longer extended cards, which are obviously absolutely fine on all-weather tracks and probably on some turf tracks where you've got the ability to share racing between straights and bends probably a bit more than I have. I just think it has to be part of the discussion. You know, and I think, and I'm sure there's a sensible way through that. I don't think it's necessarily a sort of an alarm bell situation at the moment.
And Andrew, just finally, Epsom won't be racing for the rest of this year. Just explain why.
Well, there's two fundamental reasons, and one is the economics of it. As you know, for the Derby and the Oaks this year, we put up sort of 3.5 miles of fences, big security operation. You know, it was a massive undertaking, and not taken lightly. But you know, the reality is, you would do that. I think we agree we would do that for something as important as the Derby and the Oaks, to get them run at their rightful place. But for, you know, Thursday afternoons in September, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. But of course, and the other factor in all of this is we were able to secure permission from the Downs Conservators to enclose the course for one day's racing. And though we didn't actually sort of pose the question, could we do it for more, i.e. more fixtures later in the year, at the time, it was very much at the back of our mind that we were sort of pushing the legislation just about as far as we could, and the sort of tolerance of the local community as far as we could, by taking away what, you know, many perceive as an absolute right to sort of be on Epsom Downs on any day for one day. And we didn't really think we should push it from a sort of local angle. So I think it's the combination of, you know, commercial reality and the Downs Act that control us. And of course, the fixtures that Epsom would have raced three times in September, and those have all been absorbed within the Jockey Club group, and the programmes will be maintained within the Jockey Club group. And, you know, we're even looking at there's a fixture at Epsom would normally run at the end of September, which has a Derby wildcard condition attached to it. And that's going to, we're going to keep that in the race that's going to be run at Nottingham. So I think I see no reason not to. So the programmes that, you know, trainers and owners could compete for will broadly stay the same. But though that's why Epsom really it didn't make any sense to continue to race whilst we have to behind closed doors.
Andrew, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks, Nick.
Andrew Cooper there. Lee, difficult decisions had to be taken by a number of racecourse groups. I don't think it's difficult to see why Epsom is in mothballs for the rest of the year.
No, I mean, there are a number of tracks in a semi-similar situation to Epsom, but Epsom is pretty unique in that the centre of the racecourse is public land. It's cherished public land. I live 2 miles away. I use it myself. I was walking around the racecourse last week and noted that the turf wasn't nearly as green as one might normally expect during the flat season. And obviously what Andrew says explains why. And having listened in to the council meeting at which they gained approval to stage the Derby, it was pretty clear that would be a one-off instance for this year. And listen, you know, having 1 year when you only have 2 days of racing on a track, I don't imagine that would do the racehorse any harm whatsoever. It might well do it a bit of good.
Talking about great international races across the world, you are a very keen student of what goes on in Australia, and Cox Plate entries came out today, amongst them Cameco, but I don't suppose there'll be many international runners, will there?
No, I mean, for those of us who love Melbourne in the spring, it's not looking great this year. The numbers for the Cox Plate entry are particularly strong, particularly from Ireland. The O'Brien family in between them have 22 of the nominations, with Joseph having the bulk of those. But Aidan has horses like Magical and Japan and Magic Wand entered. In reality, the comments that have come out from Melbourne overnight our time don't sound promising. That the main issue is going to be whether humans connected to those horses can get out there. Not primarily the trainers, but the stable hands. For example, Aidan always uses TJ Comerford to travel his horses to Australia. It would look at the moment, because of the situation in Victoria, and we've all seen on the news how serious things are there, it would look as though the humans won't be allowed access and entrance into Australia. And in that instance, I think it's highly unlikely that some trainers would want to send their horses, even if they are allowed. And I think there has to be a chance they won't be allowed. And so I think we could be looking at a purely Australian Cox Plate, even a purely Australian Cox Plate in terms of jockeys and Melbourne Cup as well, because again, with quarantine issues, people would have to spend a fortnight there, even if they're around the country. So I think for those punters who listen to this podcast, I think when they're looking ahead to races like the Cox Plate, and in particular the Melbourne Cup, the markets at the moment have a number of international horses in them. I think you can possibly disregard those. We've already heard today that Charlie Appleby and Saeed Bin Sura will have no runners in Australia this spring. So I think look at those Aussie horses and you're probably going to get a bigger price than you really ought to.
Well, now time for a brand new weekly segment on this podcast. It's our pedigree analysis segment, and generously sponsored today by the Weatherby's Global Stallions app. Weatherby's Global Stallions app, developed by the two leading sources for stallion information, a free app providing the most comprehensive mobile information on thoroughbred stallions throughout the world. And those sources are Weatherby's and the Blood Horse. And I'm joined by Nancy Sexton, no one more expert in this field. And we're going to talk today about first season sires, stallions who are having their first crop two-year-olds this season in Europe. Nancy, is it fair to say that this is a slightly better clutch, it seems, than perhaps we'd anticipated?
Yes, I'd agree with that. There's, you know, several sort of bubbling away that you'd really think, or they could actually be, you know, sort of very capable, useful stallions in a couple of months' time. I mean, we saw last week at Goodwood, you know, Maymas had, you know, a group winner, and Marquez had a very nice nursery winner. Twilight Sun was off the mark. I'd say that, yeah, at the moment, they're looking like a, you know, a pretty encouraging group overall.
Let's talk about Maymass, because he's one of those stallions that retired at the end of his two-year-old career, which a lot of people hate. But yes, in supremacy, certainly, he looks like a horse with easily enough presence and physique to go on beyond his two-year-old career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the one thing about the Maymass horses that we've heard so far is that they seem to be very relaxed, very honest, tough, sound horses, which I think he was himself, which I would say tends to be an acclimation thing. Of course, we would never know if Maymass had gone on to be, you know, really good three-year-old. But as you say, Supremacy looks to be a horse that will go on beyond his two-year-old year. And who knows how far Method could climb as well. I was really impressed with him in the Rose Bowl Stakes. So I'd say, you know, the people who have invested in Maymass and the supporters of Tally Ho, they'd be sort of quite encouraged by what they've seen so far from him. I mean, for all that he's, you know, got stacks of runners out there, he's also sort of firing in the winners as well.
And the acclimation point you made is interesting. Not only has Maymass come from that line, but also Dark Angel, who would be the other great sire, I think we can now call him, who retired at the end of his two-year-old career. And it always makes me wonder how good Dark Angel would have been if he'd carried on racing.
Absolutely. And he came at the time when they didn't have all these sort of three-year-old options for sprinters. And I think at the time that was put forward as an, sort of a reason why he went to stud. And of course, plenty of his horses, like Gabriel and obviously Batash and Sovereign Debt, they're still running, you know, as sort of older performers. So, you know, it's, I mean, as you say, who knows how far he could have gone if he'd stayed in training.
I suppose Maymass was an obvious first season sire with the stakes winners you just mentioned to succeed, because he covered so many mares and he's in such good commercial hands to make him successful.
Yeah.
There's a few, however, that are bubbling under that have been slightly less obvious sleeper hits, I suppose. Coolsty springs to mind.
Coolsty got the Princess Margaret winner. I think he's only got about 42-year-olds on the ground, which, you know, is a fair enough number. When you compare it to Maymass, I think they've already run sort of 120 times between them. He's got a bit of an uphill battle, but he's made a great start, I think, for a horse whose yearling average wouldn't have been huge. They're not sort of, you know, they weren't so many at the Breeze Up sales. They're not in sort of the big yards as such. And one of four Kodiaks, you know, with runners who've, and each one so far looks to be okay. I mean, Prince of Lear's obviously got the Norfolk winner. Ade started off very well. He's had plenty of winners. Cody Bear, you know, he's already got a couple of stakes horses, a nice filly that ran today at Nace, who was placed in a stakes race. So they're all looking as if, you know, Kodiak's looking as if he'll be quite a good sire of sires at the moment. Certainly encouraging start, anyway.
And on the point of fast horses, Twilight Sun had his eagerly awaited first domestic winner last week, having had a couple of winners in Italy. What about some of those whose distance requirements are likely to be slightly further? The New Bay, Bilardo territories. There's promise in all of those, isn't there?
I love the look of New Bay. His stats at the moment are off the charts, which, okay, he's, you know, he wouldn't have had as many runners as Maymass, but a bit like Knight of Thunder last year, they look to really try. They're winning at the right tracks. Okay, they've got to go on now and be stakes horses, but look, he's bred the right way. Dibari from Kingman's family, he's in excellent hands. I can see him being perhaps maybe even the best one out of this group. And territories as well. He's got plenty of maiden winners bubbling under. And Teresa Mendoza, she looked really good, I thought. Did she win at the Curra? And I think she runs this week in the stakes race. And again, he's bred to be a stallion, you know, invincible spirit from Chamadal's family. So, and Bilardo too. There's a good chat about his stock earlier in the year, and that seems to be coming through right now. You know, the horse that won at Goodwood, John Quinn's, he looks a smart horse. Titan Rock. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's plenty of, you know, to be encouraged about, I'd say.
Well, Nancy, thank you. And we will be back next week to do it all again. Lee Motter said it just remains for you to provide us all with a winner for either this afternoon or any day of your choosing.
Well, I mean, I'll stick to today while reminding listeners of that message about backing Aussie horses for the Melbourne Cup. And I'll repeat, shared ambition, very elegant. I said that before. 8:15 at Lingfield, though, is rather less prestigious than the Melbourne Cup. It's a 1 mile class 6 apprentices handicap, but I would suggest horse number 11 in that, called Good Luck Charm. 11-year-old, he's an old boy trained by Gary Moore. Doesn't win very often, but he does love a track with a bit of a hill. He's gone very well at Brighton in the past. He's gone well at Lingfield, where he won last year. He likes the place. The downhill run into the straight, I think, helps him. And I think at 11 years old, you can't expect him to win very often, but he is due a win. And I think Good Luck Charm in the 8:15 at Lingfield tonight could be his night.
Lee, thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow. If you do enjoy this podcast, please rate, review and subscribe. And you can subscribe on SoundCloud, on Spotify, on iTunes and on Google. See you tomorrow. That was Tuesday, August the 4th. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.